Today on Against the Grain. In the 2000s, various left-leaning governments swept to power in Latin America, known as the Pink Tide, raising the hopes of many around the world. But their successes were limited, and in places like Brazil, center-left governments have now been replaced by the hard right. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Gianpaolo Baiocchi about the crisis of the left in Latin America, Europe, and North America, and what could be done to reimagine a radical left project. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's not news that the left has been in a decades-long crisis, but as activist and scholar Gianpaolo Baiocchi argues, the irony is that if leftism, as an institutional and political project, feels like it's floundering, it's not due to an absence of social mobilizations or even the currency of leftist ideas. It's almost as if there were two separate worlds, the vibrant world of movements and mobilization and the sterile and uninspired world of political parties. Originally from Brazil, Baiocchi directs the Urban Democracy Lab at NYU and has written a thought-provoking assessment of the state of the left and what might be needed to renew it. It's titled We the Sovereign, and it's published by Polity Books. Gianpaolo, I wanted to begin by asking you to describe for us the contours of the left since the disintegration of the Soviet Union. What has it looked like in the 1990s, 2000s, and 2010s?
So for me, and the argument I lay out in the book, is that it's a sort of a left without footing. And if we look at Western Europe and the United States and North America, it's social democratic parties tilting to the right in an attempt to capture a sort of social base that they seem to be losing and they can't quite figure out why. And on the other hand, you have the more left parties somehow losing whatever electoral stronghold they had. So institutionally, it's that for me. It's a sort of tilt right of the social democratic part of it and a sort of disconnect from the more left parts of it. At the same time, you have very, very exciting social movements. So you have the Alter Globalization movement, you have the World Social Forum. You have lots and lots of excitement on that front, continuing all the way up through Occupy, Black Lives Matter, Arab Spring, and so on. And so what I try to do in the book is to think about that disjuncture. How did we get here? And more importantly, what can we do about it? And then if you look at the sort of movement criticisms or the worry of movements in Western Europe and in North America about political parties, they're all pretty well-founded. In other words, if you looked around the world around the time of Occupy or all some of the other movements I write about, there is a really well-earned suspicion of these social democratic and quite technocratic political parties. And it's interesting if you look in the various countries. For example, I write a bit about Spain, and I happen to be there in the 2011-2012 period. There's a tremendous suspicion on the part of the organized left of the new social movements that seem to be appearing. You know, they said they didn't have platforms, they didn't have programs, they didn't seem to be leftist enough, they weren't organized. It's just people sitting around all the time. So I try to think about this distance between movements and parties. And to me, also, that has to do, this disjuncture partially explains the populist right. So I think there's lots and lots of explanations for the rise of the populist right. And if we think about Erdogan, if we think about Bolsonaro, Trump, whoever. But one of the things that I really wanted to talk about in the book is how we on the left have not done our jobs.
And how do you come to terms with this yawning gap right between political parties on the one hand, social movements on the other? Do you think of them as really inhabiting the same left? Is there really a relationship between them at all that we should be thinking about? Like when we're talking about them, can we talk about them in the same breath? Do they have just such different political constituencies and ideologies?
So every book, I think, has a fairy dust moment. And the fairy dust is when the author sprinkles some fairy dust and makes it so. And the fairy dust in this book is that I wish to think of them in the same way and talk about them in the same breath and think about them with the same terms. and really ask the question, okay, so in the U.S., for example, it is different constituencies. In the U.K., a little bit less, but it is different constituencies. In Spain, in Italy, why is that, and what can we do about it? One of the things I read about it, what might a renewed relationship look like? How can we do the things that we do in social movements, bring that energy, that creativity, that innovativeness to a sort of institutional stage that parties are good at without losing something? And on the other hand, how can parties function as representatives, as voices, as amplifying our demands from movements without instrumentalizing them? Because parties do tend to try to do that.
Right. And of course, as you write about in your book, there's a deep suspicion within the social movement left of political parties, and of course extending much further than social movements. That, I mean, within the left, obviously, there's the whole history of Stalinism. There's the history of social democratic parties, in effect, moving to the center right. But more broadly, through the society as a whole, on left and right, there is a disaffection that people have with organized political parties that characterizes our times. And so it is certainly something where to reach that place which you're striving to reach does swim against the tide of a lot of the politics of our moment.
Yeah, and I think political parties need to own up to it. I had the opportunity to participate in this Next Left group, thinking group, a few years ago, part of the Socialist International. This was mostly social democratic parties. And you have these strategists and well-known figures, these are mostly European, thinking about this divide, but not owning up to why it exists in the first place. You know, they would say, we need better policies. We need to reach more people. We need more effective advertisement. I remember one time someone said, well, we need to put things on the subway. We need to get more clever marketing. And I think political, that's not the way. We have to really dig into why is it that parties are, for so many people, ineffectual, right? Why are they instruments of elite?
And that's the question. What's the argument that you would marshal that parties are salvageable or should be salvaged, given that obviously on the left, there are those who will say that parties just by definition are going to suck the life out of social movements. Political parties in power are going to end up cozying up to the powers that be or become the powers that be themselves. So why should we try to reclaim parties?
Yeah, so there's a couple of reasons why we need to. One is if we don't engage in institutional space, the right is happy that we're not there, right? Second, there's all kinds of issues that whatever our politics on the left might be, are issues that need to be resolved institutionally. There's institutional things that need to happen. But in the salvaging I propose in here, when I look at what I think are some of the more successful examples, is a pretty radical rethinking of political parties. So I cannot imagine a salvageable Democratic Party, for example, right? The successful examples that I write about in here, the Workers' Party in its heyday, the MAS, they were looking at the same history, and they were people coming from movements, and they were trying to think of ways for a new praxis around political power. What might it look like? So some of the slogans, leading by following, right, is a little bit different than the West European way of having one foot in, one foot out of institutions. It really is the idea of a party that is supposed to be a reflex of movements. The idea that a party ought to be an instrument of movements, or that a section of a party ought to be an instrument, or a party where social movements could speak. And just as a thought experiment, not to pick on the Democrats, but they've earned it.
Oh, go ahead.
Could you imagine at the Democratic Convention not just having symbolic activists, but say, okay, now this is the part of the convention where we give voice to Right to the City for 15 minutes, we give voice to Black Lives Matter for 15 minutes, we give voice to LGBT activism for 15 minutes. That would be a completely different structure, right? I mean, the elite capture of parties, the technocratic capture of parties, you know, the Democratic Party is in business to stay in business, right? And the kind of thing we're thinking about in the successful examples here really came about when people said, okay, We have no models. The old left is no more. We are in social movements. We have to engage institutions in some way. What might that look like?
Well, let's talk about some of the examples that you explore in your book, We the Sovereign. And I should say that I'm speaking with Gianpaolo Baiocchi, a New York City-based activist and scholar, about his book, We the Sovereign. Remind us about the pink tide that swept through Latin America in the 2000s. What was it? What propelled it to power?
So the pink tide was actually, I think, the English language moniker that that someone in The Guardian might have come up with that doesn't, it's funny, you talk about the pink tide in some of these places and people don't understand, but people refer to the pink tide as these left of center governments that emerged in the region, and from Brazil all the way to Central American countries, but extending throughout. And so by 2010, 2011, at the Organization of American States, some journalists remarked, oh my goodness, you look around the room and you have liberation theologians, you have former political prisoners, you have union activists, you have indigenous activists who've all come to power with various different versions of these new left-wing sort of parties. The Pink Tide as a whole was a really momentous shift. I write about in the book about some of the facts and figures, but over these 10, 15 years, the continent was really transformed. If you look at the number of people in schools, people in the formal labor market, people with access to basic food, the number of poor people, it all changed quite dramatically. But by and large, these were, in some way or another, fairly social democratic type governments. These were governments that were trying to foster growth, investing in infrastructure, and some measures of redistribution. In most cases, they didn't strike at property structures. They didn't try to change the media. They weren't transformative. So it ended. People now are talking about a right turn in Latin America. Most of these governments have now been voted out. We're having a sort of right-wing backlash. And it's interesting that the right-wing backlash makes these governments seem much more leftist than they were. These governments were very friendly to capital. They're very friendly to, in most cases, to large landowners. They're very friendly to media conglomerates. They pushed back to the U.S. on some issues, but by and large were quite friendly with the United States. But so the discussion we have in the left in the United States today about the pink tide is, okay, these were these reformist governments that they came in, they did some stuff, wasn't enough, and now there's a right-wing backlash. And what I wanted to go back to in the book was actually the 80s and 90s, which was a period of pretty intense creativity, new political praxis, a lot of innovative ways of thinking about movements and parties, where people went from quite dire circumstances and pretty difficult to being able to build movements, to being able to build parties, to be able to win local power, to be able to pass a lot of progressive laws, and winding up at, you know, in national government.
So you're talking 80s and 90s 80s. Being the period before the pink tide, when
these
social movements were forming and starting to flex their power.
That's right. And so in a way, in many of these cases, it's certainly true of the Workers' Party,
in Brazil,
which comes into power 2002-2003 with Lula. It was a surprise that they got to national power, and in many ways they were unprepared to do it. They always had a national plan of government. It was a democratic transition plan, which was supposed to be building democratic institutions and walking the country to socialism. But no one actually, or many people did not expect they would actually win. So they had done very, very interesting thing at local levels, at government, at the state levels, with legislature. They had built these relationships with movements, with unions. And the national period was a bit of a surprise. They carried out many, many very successful policies, but in lots of ways it was almost a rupture from the previous period.
We'll return to the sort of ultimate fate of the Workers' Party.
Right.
But since Your point here is for us to look at these governments and the movements that were connected to them in their heyday and see what lessons can be drawn from them. Let's look at one of the other ones that stand out, and that is the movement for socialism in Bolivia, or MAS. How did that form, and what was the relationship of the Bolivian government of Evo Morales to the social movements that preceded his election to power?
So MAS has a very interesting history in that they emerged a little bit after the Workers' Party. So they emerged out of indigenous movements that were engaged in a number of battles, including battle for survival. And then this was a period of extractivism. So a lot of movements began to flex their muscles in Bolivia in the beginning of the late 90s and then through the early 2000s. Over issues like hydrocarbons, over the defense of nature. And they had this idea, looking at the Workers' Party of Brazil, which had preceded them, the Workers' Party had this idea that it was a party where movements could speak. And already in Bolivia, they were looking at that and saying that they wanted a different model. So they had this idea of the party as instrument. So the MAS, which emerges for bureaucratic reasons, the Bolivian law sort of limits the number of the names of political parties. So they wound up with MAS out of a pre-existing. But its original name was a political instrument for the popular sovereignty. And the idea was there's the Federation of Indigenous Movements, which was a combination which had indigenous people in it, which had displaced peasant farmers. We had former miners. And the idea was the MAS was supposed to be just a reflex. Whatever was happening in social movements, the MAS was supposed to carry it out. They were very successful at running a couple of local administrations. And in doing so, they began to capture the imagination of middle-class intellectuals, urban unions, urban movements. And when Morales wins in 2005, it's a watershed moment for the region. It's the first indigenous president, something that really would have been unthinkable. But he comes in this sort of ambiguous role as president of the country, as leader of a movement, and as leader of a party. Then his government carries out many progressive policies, including a rewrite of the Constitution, passes some interesting laws about about nature and the environment, carries out some redistributive platforms. But what the MAS did not do was it actually came to a sort of standoff with some of the rich landowners and with some industry. And it wound up being a government of compromise. So carrying out progressive policies, having this tremendously important thing of an indigenous president, rewriting the Constitution, but at the same time never quite engaging the sort of class enemies who were engaging the government negatively all the time. So one of the ways to think about the MAS trajectory as a party is that it becomes almost paranoid about these class enemies and about these national enemies and about foreign influence, and very much centered on the figure of Morales himself, who turns out to be a fantastically eloquent speaker, a very, very popular person, a guy with tremendous appeal. And so a lot of the ideas of the MAS being a reflex, an instrument, something that the instrument, if you look at the original writings on it, the idea was, look, the movements might say, we don't want to be in the White House anymore. We don't want to be in the presidency anymore. We're changing direction, or we want to replace this person. All of that was supposed to be possible. But the MAS, and part of that was that the MAS never formalized a lot of these structures in order to remain, they didn't want to be tied down to a sort of overly bureaucratic set of rules. And what that has done, unfortunately, it has remained very centered on his figure. And some of the things I write about is now some movements broke out of MAS, and they, very progressive indigenous movements, and the government starts describing them as enemies of the state, enemies of the people, influenced by bourgeois ideologies, which is a very, very negative sort of development.
How would you place the Zapatistas in this? Obviously, they came to power through different means in an earlier period, in 1995. What is your assessment of the relationship between the Zapatistas as an institutional power and the Zapatistas as a social movement?
Interesting. So one of the things I wanted to do with this book is to do something that discuss the Zapatistas a little bit differently than we discuss them all the time. I've heard from people in Podemos in Spain that at the founding of Podemos, the neo-Zapatistas and the neo-Bolivarians were having debates. But in Latin America, in many places, for example, the World Social Forum, the Zapatistas exist in a continuum of leftist movements that have some relationship to parties and the state. And the Zapatistas chose the outside route because there was no, the assessment was strategically, there's nothing in it for them. Where they are in Mexico, winning those elections or capturing that part of the state would have meant nothing. So I discuss in the book a sort of inside, alongside, and outside sort of strategies. And the Zapatistas strategically make this decision to remain outside, build a sort of counterpower, try to achieve some measure of autonomy within the Mexican nation state, and build and build and build. And interestingly, the Zapatistas have, beginning with the other campaign in the mid-2000s, have begun to turn an eye to making alliances with other movements in Mexico that have a greater institutional presence. Now, the Zapatistas are very... They're one of the wonderful things about the Zapatistas, actually, is just the plurality of positions that exist within the movement. There are people who worry about too much engagement with the broken institutions of Mexican democracy. And there are people who worry about leaving people behind who are, in a sense, comrades, who could be benefiting from Zapatista knowledge, who could be building with them in some way. So the Zapatistas, to me, are one of the interesting things we need to, one of the interesting examples we need to look at, not just for how you build something outside, but for this acknowledgement that even in the outside and building that, you have to have eventually some relationship with the inside, you know. And the wonderful thing about the Zapatistas is that they are able to dictate those terms.
Well, let's talk about some of the, and you've started to do this already, but some of the contradictions that took place within some of these pink-tide governments, the challenges that were faced not only by trying to ally social movements with political parties, but also questions about representation, who speaks for whom, how do we think about the tension between individuals and collectives within some of these organizations. How did those sort of complexities come out in these different examples?
One of the interesting things for us to learn when we look at these movements, you know, with an eye to building in the now, is that they faced what to me is one of the core tricky issues for left political practice, which is, what is it that we value? Do we value a horizontal, egalitarian set of relationships where every speaking person or every person is an equal? Or do we value more collectivities and particular identities? And to me, this plays out in pretty negative ways in the United States at the moment. I feel like the way people on the left today still talk about identity politics within some of these spaces is absolutely unproductive. And what the history of these movements shows and what people in these movements realize is that these are two things that we actually value, but they need to be salient at different moments. So the Workers' Party in Brazil, being as it was formed as a party of movements, where movements could speak, there was a lot of emphasis on people speaking for collectivities. So a women's caucus, Afro-Brazilians, indigenous people, students, this idea of sectors, almost. The rainbow of movements was something that was very valued. This particular language of identity is less salient in some other parts. So, for example, if you look at the mass or the way people think about the mass, surely you have a rainbow of movements at certain points, but that's not necessarily what is valued. If you look at Zapatista territory, there's a lot of emphasis on, there's this language of a world where many worlds can speak and diversity. But it's slightly more individualistic. There's a lot more emphasis on the horizontal assembly. So the complexity, I think, comes from us being able to figure out what should matter at a particular point. What they figured out when you arrive at some of these places is that these are sort of logics that can be salient at different times, and one doesn't take away from the other. I write about a little bit about the indignados in Spain, and one of the things that they
emerge in 2011, seize the plaza as part of worldwide people seizing public space and protesting austerity.
Yeah, depending on who you ask, it's the Occupy of Spain, or in Spain they say, the indignados of the United States, or if you go to the Arab Spring. But the ripple of movements in the 2010s, roughly, one of the signatures of that was a real emphasis on the egalitarian moment. Every person, every being is an equal in our assemblies. The way we talk to each other reflects that, because the world we want should reflect that. And in Spain, where the language of identity politics is less salient, I think, for social justice in some way. If you talk to comrades in Spain, they find our U.S. emphasis on some of that a bit odd, maybe. They decided from the very beginning to not recognize collectivity. So when they occupied the plaza, they had this no parties, no banners sort of motto. So no parties were allowed, but also no banners of particular causes, but which also meant, for example, a women's caucus did not exist. And if you look at Spain now, if you look at some of the criticisms that are emerging of what has become of the indignados, those critiques are, look, there has been an inattention to immigrant realities. Spain is 12% Latin American. I don't see people of Latin American descent represented in Podemos, for example. So the trick or the lesson is which moment, choosing one or the other in a particular moment doesn't mean it has to be like that all the time. These are moments. So I think it's quite possible, and I think these movements show that you can have a very strong recognition of collectivities, of groups, of identities, at the same time as espousing this ethic of having a horizontal egalitarian gathering, because that's the society we want.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of We the Sovereign. It's published by Polity Books, and its author is Gianpaolo Baiocchi. He is the director of the Urban Democracy Lab at NYU, and his other books include Militants and Citizens. So we've been discussing the pink tide in Latin America, these left-leaning governments that came to power, and their complicated relationship with social movements. And then, of course, around 2010, 2011, 12, there were movements that sprung up around the world. And some of them, you were speaking earlier about Podemos in Spain, found a political party expression. In other places, other things happened. But looking back, and you do make the caveat that we should be a little careful as we look back, not to just sort of assume that it was just inevitable that everything ended up badly, and that's just the fate of how these things go. But what is your assessment of this marriage of social movements and political parties turned out? Because for some people, they would say, well, this is not surprising at all. When social movements come to power as political parties, they get corrupted by being in power. What did you expect?
Yeah, so we can use the example of Brazil, actually, because now, as people know, Brazil, we've elected an extreme right-wing president, which who rode a wave of anti-leftist sentiment, which should be surprising in some way, because if nothing else, these left-wing governments under the Workers' Party were redistributed and redistributive, and lots of people fared quite well. So what happened? The story of the Workers' Party national government, as I was saying earlier, to me is partially a story of a party being unprepared to assume national power. So when they were in local power, or even at the state level power, there was a lot of emphasis on preserving social movement autonomy, having social movement speak, and popular politics providing a counterweight. So in any of the successful Workers' Party local administrations in Brazil, there was a lot of worry on the part of administrators or Workers' Party sort of leaders of not instrumentalizing social movements. This was literally the language that they spoke of. And the centerpiece of that was that they had these programs of participation that I read about that were really meaningful. There were lots of, the Workers' Party was known as the party of participation, but it was a party where people could actually go and make real meaningful decisions that were sometimes against what the party would have wished. This was the sort of centerpiece. When they won national government, I think there was a part of the Workers' Party, there were some people who thought they should carry that logic forward into national government, and some people who thought the most important thing was to reassure re-election, stay in power, redistribute some things, lift the floor up in terms of basic social provision, and in time we'll be able to return to that. When they arrived, I think they realized a couple of things. One is that Brazilian politics are deeply, deeply corrupt at the national level, and it's very difficult to govern. So they immediately entered into coalitions with every which difficult right-wing party you could think of to govern. They gave out ministry positions to every which of those parties also. And so while it did very many important things, for example, like introducing affirmative action, for example, like introducing the income redistribution program, the Bolsa Família, or introducing programs to increase the number of students in universities, even though they were doing that, the sort of centerpieces of popular participation as something meaningful disappeared. The idea of having a popular counterweight, which was a sort of key strategic move, ceased to be. So they did have a lot of meetings. I don't know if I cite in the book, but someone actually figured out that five or 6 million people actually went to Brasilia throughout the 8 years of Lula to have a meeting.
This is the capital.
This is the capital. So he would have assemblies on many, many issues. LGBT conference, human rights conference, environmental conference, many, many people from social movements would go, regular people would go and attend, but there was nothing or very little that could come out of those meetings that you would say, okay, this is the people decided that we're going to have capital controls. The people decided we're no longer going to subsidize the soy industry. People decided we're going to have land reform. The people decided we're going to break up the media monopolies, which were things people were talking about. So there was a lot of listening, but not a lot of action, and people were not being mobilized in this kind of popular politics strategy. So to return to the municipal example for a second, the city of Porto Alegre in the south of Brazil, which was the place that hosted some of the first World Social Forums, was a city that is famous for many things, but one of them for mobilizing people to raise property taxes. One of the first and only pro-taxation movements that I know of happened there because people decided to invest more in infrastructure and they were mobilized. They were going to meetings all the time. They knew their voice mattered. So they agitated to have more taxes. And the local elites, whatever mechanisms of pressure they had against the local government, couldn't compete with mobilized people. So, but at the national level, you had important redistribution programs. You had a lot of important issues being brought to the table and talked about in Brazil for the first time. You had a lot of important social successes, but you did not have this sort of mobilization on one hand, and you didn't have this idea of popular voice, direct popular voice. And what you had instead was compromises all the time. So if you look over the years of the Workers' Party administration, so 3.5 terms, unions became less militant. The number of college students doubled, but the number of students in the student unions didn't increase. The number of people with homes increased, but the homeowners' sort of neighborhood associations didn't increase.
So there was kind of a political demobilization of the left, in effect.
Yes, because, you know, there's this phrase people use in Brazil sometimes. This is our friend's government, or a government of our friends, or a friendly government. And if you look at Lula's first term, end of Lula's second term, Dilma's first term, if you look at the landless movement, a movement that has fought very hard to maintain a sort of measure of autonomy from the Workers' Party, they did not support the re-election until the last minute. And then they would say, well, it's obviously better than the right. And now the landless movement is fighting very hard to resist this right-wing government that we are about to have. But it was a kind of like least of all evils.
You quote, I think it's one of the founders of the Workers' Party, reflecting on the experience of the Workers' Party and saying that what the party ended up achieving was inclusion, but not transformation. Now, transformation is a much harder project than inclusion, and there are many structural obstacles. Do you believe that a much more profound transformation was possible given those obstacles had these movements been mobilized?
I have to think so. I have to think so because so that was Olivia Dutra, one of the founders of the Workers' Party. So big T transformation may not have been on the table, but many other transformations were. For example, there was a lot of talk of reforming the political system, the political reform in Brazil, for example, that would have made corruption more difficult, would have increased public finance, there was talk of having gender quotas, all kinds of interesting stuff that is in line with a progressive social change of the country and in line with Workers' Party principles, but which because of political compromises, they didn't pursue. Another one which would have made a lot of difference would have been to break up the media monopolies in Brazil. Brazil, as people may know, has essentially one powerful media conglomerate that everyone watches and has a conglomerate that owns, you know, the two newspapers that everyone reads. The Workers' Party could have very easily have at least mobilized people around the idea of reforming that, or it could have tried to build a more robust public alternative. Lots of things that could have been done but weren't pursued in name of compromise.
One of the things that I want to raise is that obviously there's a critique of political parties that's widespread on the left, and we've been talking about it during this hour. But on the other hand, that critique often tends to see social movements as, without their contradictions, as a kind of uniformly virtuous force. And yet, social movements can be highly diverse, ideologically, politically, and we can celebrate that on the one hand. But on the other hand, it could actually lead to politics that are very contradictory and for radicals might actually not be radical at all. Do you see that at play in thinking about these questions?
I do. And, you know, one of the things that a party or a reimagined political party could or should do is provide a space for discussion, right? I don't know of a forum in the United States today where main social movements can sit down and talk strategy. I don't know of, I mean, there's many think tanks. I don't know of one think tank that is proposing, that's taking social movement ideas and then moving them into actionable policy, another thing political parties could do. And I think there needs to be, for sure, a place where we can talk about the limits of existing social movements and some of the funny politics they sometimes adopt without being from the right. You know, I think we on the left, you know, depending on where you sit, we feel protective of our social movements because it feels like, look, this is the resistance. But even the resistance has had its contradictions, as I'm sure, you know, pick your example.
Gianpaolo Baiocchi is a New York City-based activist and scholar. And we're talking about his book, We the Sovereign. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, in the time that we have left, I want to talk about the kind of prescriptive aspect of your book, because you assess these experiences, especially the experience of the Pink Tide in Latin America, its failures, but also the aspects that you think are valuable and we should hold on to. And you argue that we really can't afford to abandon attempts at institutional change, but that the institutions that exist are put in place to keep left-wing change from happening much of the time. So these are the state institutions. And of course, there's a lot of debate on the left about the state. Do we seize it? Do we abandon it? Is it possible to exit altogether? If that's not possible, what do we do? You come at it with a concept which in many ways is kind of foreign to people in the U.S. left, except perhaps when discussing Native American issues, and that is sovereignty. What does sovereignty actually mean, and why do you think it's something worth reclaiming?
Yeah, it's interesting. In the conversations I've had in the lead up to the publication of the book, there's two sort of big questions people have. One that we've been talking about is, really, wasn't the Pink Tide a failure, and what can we learn from that? And two, why do you hang on to this concept of sovereignty? So sovereignty means, at a very basic level, the ability to make decisions over the conditions of your life, right? And so the idea of popular sovereignty was common currency on the left in Latin America in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And that's a concept that I try to rescue. So, and it's a contradictory term, because sovereignty sovereignty is most often associated with the state. And the state, as we know, is in Latin America, but also here, colonial settler state, with rules and institutions divided primarily to reproduce racial capitalism, to protect the powers of elites, sanctified in the national form, which, to take the case of the native movements in this continent, doesn't work. Right, the nation states and native nations don't necessarily align all the time. So why hold on to it? So a couple of reasons. I think it's interesting and important for us on the left to have an imaginative relationship with the idea of decision making. What would it mean if we actually ruled? On some issues, we need to maybe go to the lifeboats. Right, some institutions, and there's a W.B. Du Bois is one of the first people to articulate it so well, but people have struggled with this, which is, if you think about abolition democracy, when Du Bois is writing about Reconstruction, we need to strengthen and protect some institutions, and he's thinking about things like literacy, but some can't be reformed, and he's thinking about the justice system, so-called justice system and police. So what would it mean for us to take power and actually be the ones deciding? So I want us to continue to have that space of imagination, right? We're going to abolish the prison industrial complex, but what do we want in its stead, right? So popular sovereignty, as it emerges on the left in Latin America, is this idea of bringing together these contradictory notions: decision making, enlisting the state, controlling it, but at the same time not losing our souls and our imaginations to it as people coming from social movement. Some of the things the state can do are things that we cannot do, right? Some of the things the state needs to do, for example, on climate change, are things that we cannot do outside of its institutions. So how do we enlist it without losing what makes us social movements, what makes us left, what makes us excited to get up and work for social change every day? So that was the provocation of the book.
It's a question that has a history, a long history, but certainly it seems that in the last few decades that the relationship to the state, of the left to the state, has become a more pressing one, partly because as the tides of sort of revolutionary change have receded, then the question is what to do. And so some of these ideas seem to, correct me if I'm wrong, draw from Antonio Gramsci and perhaps Le Clau and Mouffe and the idea of Eurocommunism, which was explored in the 70s and 80s in the communist parties of Italy and Spain. But you argue that as we think about a kind of reconfigured relationship of the state with active social movements trying to transform this relationship, the ends that you put in front of us are transforming the nation state and private property, which are ends which would be hard to describe as sort of simple reformism. How do you think of that being possible within the constraints of capitalism as we know it, and the constraints of the strength of the left, the radical forces, social movements in our time?
So the book owes a lot to Antonio Gramsci, but Antonio Gramsci put through liberation theology and popular education in Latin America in the 80s and 90s, which is a more democratic Gramsci, I think. Yeah, so to go back to the thought experiment, what would it mean for the people to actually rule? There's two things that would get in its way. One is private property and one is the nation state. For us to really be masters of our fate, neither of those things can hold. And so it is a battle inside, alongside, outside, but through institutions. And there's a phrase of Subcomandante Marcos that I think sort of captures it. The point is not for us to occupy the state, and it's not even for us to occupy the state and pass radical policies once we're there. The point is for us to transform ourselves and transform society as we make our way towards a transformed state. So the idea being is this, you know, making the road as we walk it. I know people reading the book will find my returning to that all the time. It might be slightly irritating, but I think it's a central idea. Once we freeze popular sovereignty to a particular set of prescriptions, to a particular set of rules and blueprints, then we've frozen ourselves to a bureaucratic mandate. Then we will become small bureaucrats or legitimators of bureaucratic mandates. We have to, on the way towards this, I don't know if end state, but walking towards this abolition of private property, of the nation state, of towards popular rule, we have to be able to be willing all the time to abandon institutional templates as we see fit.
Discussions of sovereignty and the relationship with the state as an ongoing process may seem very abstract to listeners. So I wonder if just very concretely you could say, what would this look like in practice? Like if the strength of social movements existed to start claiming popular sovereignty within the state, what exactly would that look like? How would it differ from the sort of hollow shell of liberal democracy? What would this look like in practice down on earth?
Yeah. As a thought experiment, let's talk about the Green New Deal for a second, which is an idea that's been floating around. So the Green New Deal, this idea that we're going to transition our economy away from extractivism towards a sustainable, socially just economy provides, I think, an interesting opening. So what would that mean at first step? Okay, so imagine we elected enough people who were connected to movements to push those ideas forward. The first thing they would do, I think, is they would, okay, we regulate industry. Then I think we need a jobs program. Then I think we need to regulate consumption. Then we need to rethink our infrastructure. And in the process of doing that, we would come up against limits all the time, right?
And are you talking about within the Democratic Party as the vehicle, potentially?
I suppose it's almost unthinkable to imagine people getting elected outside of that, of having a relationship with the Democratic Party. But let's just say they somehow manage that, right? Then what is the next step? Well, you're going to start to create jobs, and you're going to run into lobbyists, and you're going to run into laws, and you're going to run into different kinds of efforts to prevent you from having this public works program. Then as you're going back to your social movements, people are saying, look, to have a public works program around a Green New Deal, we need to have a living wage. We need to have democratic workplaces. And so the transformation continues through that. And to my mind, Green New Deal or any kind of environmental issue pushes us to the very important realization that these can't be nationally bound solutions. But the idea is to begin with a particular issue around which you can build a popular constituency, right? So one of the central ideas of popular sovereignty is that you begin with a historic block of people who are oppressed, so a people, and the people forcing on this issue and having some representatives within the political institutions pushing forward those ideas but being responsive to the new things that we're coming up with on the movement side and pushing and pushing and pushing. And every time you would push the Green New Deal, I think, you would come up against the structural limits of the state. Then you'd have to mobilize, to follow the Latin America example, a sort of popular constituency. We need a living wage for this public works program that's part of the Green New Deal, and so on and so on. So it is a little different, I think, than the Euro-communist view, but it does owe this idea to Gramsci, I think, of the march through institutions.
Well, I'm afraid we're totally out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so flattered to be here.
Gianpaolo Baiocchi has been my guest. We've been discussing his book, We the Sovereign. You can find that on our website, againstthegrain.org. It's published by Polity Books. His other books include Militants and Citizens, and he directs the Urban Democracy Lab at NYU. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.